Before we start this podcast, we would like to take the opportunity to mention that we now have a Patreon page where you can help to support, evolve and continue these compassionate conversations. Please visit patreon.com/vocedialogues for more information. Listen!
Welcome everyone to the Voce Dialogues, Voices of Compassionate Evolution. I'm Chloe Goodchild, founder of The Naked Voice, and this is our new online community where we are exploring, deepening, and evolving our awareness of the transforming power of compassion. Enjoy these new dialogues with a wide range of artists, musicians, writers and philosophers, social entrepreneurs and sacred activists. They are all visionaries, transforming lives through the art of conscious creative expression with practices inspired by their own unique life experience. The Voce Dialogues are dedicated to the compassionate evolution of life on Earth. Hello, everyone, and it's my great privilege to be in conversation today with Phil Borges, photographer, author, and filmmaker. Hello, Phil.
Hello, Chloe.
So, Phil, I just want everybody to know just a little bit of your background. For over 25 years, you've been documenting Indigenous and tribal cultures, striving to create an understanding of the challenges that they face. Your work is exhibited in museums and galleries worldwide, and you've hosted television documentaries on Indigenous cultures and shamanism for Discovery and National Geographic channels. Phil, you also regularly present at universities, you teach workshops, you've spoken at multiple TED events. In fact, that's where I first heard you. And more recently, your incredible documentary, Crazy Wise, which came out a couple of years ago, reveals the paradigm shift that's changing the way Western culture defines and treats mental illness. Your film highlights a survivor-led movement demanding more choices for a mental health care system that's presently in crisis and has been in crisis for quite some time. So, Phil, there are extraordinary kind of parallels and crossovers between our respective disciplines and life experience and so on. And it's in the light of that that I was just so inspired to contact you and just to really ask you how you came into this work in the first place and what part has compassion played in your own life? And then how has that played itself out through this extraordinary work with your documentaries and with transforming the mental health care system?
Okay. Well, we'll try and do it in 30 minutes. Well, my attraction to Indigenous and tribal people most likely came from my time when I was around 10, 11 years old. I began living on a ranch, farm/ranch in Utah. And it was back in the 50s. And it was in a little community where everybody knew each other in a beautiful valley, snow-capped mountains and surrounding us. And I absolutely loved it. We grew all our own food. We very seldomly went into town to do any shopping at grocery store or for anything else, once in a while for farm equipment. I would spend my summers there and go back and living in not a ghetto by any means, but a lower middle class tract development where there was very little greenery around. And I certainly wasn't out in nature like I was back on the farm. So that was just a highlight of my life. So I guess that's where it came from. I just was attracted to visiting communities, small communities where people know each other, where they live mostly off the land. Some were hunter-gatherers, some were agricultural or pastoralists, but that's where that came from, I believe. I just had a love of that and was attracted to that and photography. And so I started documenting these indigenous and tribal groups, and mainly around human rights issues. I wanted to tell stories that would help them. So I was doing a lot of human rights stories around indigenous and tribal cultures.
Incredible. Was your family involved in supporting this? Who were your own kind of immediate tribal influences in this? Or did it just literally, were you just born like this with this kind of extraordinary sensitivity and awareness of the need to really take care of nature and of the interface between humanity and nature and so on?
No, my immediate family that I was born into, my dad died when I was young, and my mom wasn't a part of the ranch or the farm. It was actually my older sister who married into that family.
Ah.
And they more or less adopted me into the ranch because I was a real hard worker when I was a kid. And they loved that. And I loved doing it. And so we just bonded over that. So I can't say I was born into it, but I grew to love it.
And so you came into it with almost like with that sort of innate sense of really the importance of fighting for the rights of the underdog or with those that were not really being appreciated for who they really were and are.
Exactly. In fact, I was sent there by my mother because I was getting into trouble in the area where I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area because I loved firecrackers and I was selling them. I had a huge business and they were illegal. And so she sent me there to get me out of that environment. And I just redirected my energy into nature and being around nature. Plus, when we were doing the fencing on the land, we were using dynamite. So I was in hog heaven. You know, I had everything I wanted on the ranch.
Amazing. So that gives you that sense of aliveness and your longing for to find that aliveness in, you know, in real ways, was playing itself out through the firecrackers. It's just really far out, isn't it? What were the firecrackers, what were they catalyzed by? What gave rise to that?
Oh, I just loved them.
Yeah.
You mean when I was a kid? And yeah. Then there was an aspect to the whole business that I loved. Because I had to go down into Chinatown, what we called Chinatown in Oakland,
okay,
to buy them. And I would have to go to the back of these grocery stores where I met with the owner who didn't speak any English. And we would do the deal. And it was all, you know, this going into another culture and getting these beautifully wrapped firecrackers that I loved. Anyway, it was all.
Oh, that's a lot of fun.
And you know, going into another culture, I guess that's another thing that I really found fascinating. So, yeah.
It's so interesting, isn't it?
What I ended up doing.
When you think of what James Hillman's The Soul's Code, you know, that we come in with specific kind of DNA and information that we come in with. And there's a kind of specific theme and a calling, if you like. It sounds like you had a really strong fascination, obviously an immense imagination, and obviously not any fear or apprehension around moving into different realms and so on. It sounds like you just had an innate confidence to be able to move in different environments with ease.
Yeah, well, I think it was more an innate curiosity. I've always been curious about people that live different lifestyles. Yeah, that was it that drove it. Mostly it was curiosity.
Yeah.
And photography was a great medium for me because it was like having a key into other worlds. I could go into these other worlds and have a reason for being there. Mm-hmm. I'm here to photograph. Yeah. And I use the photography as kind of a magic show in these cultures I went into, because back then when I was doing it in the early days, it was all film, and mostly you go into a place where they hadn't seen a camera or they hadn't even seen their face represented in a mirror or on a piece of paper like a photograph. So I could go in and just perform this magic show of shooting Polaroids and giving them pictures of themselves. And that would be my kind of opening to get to know the people in the community.
Oh, I love it. That's absolutely brilliant. And that has kind of parallels in my own life with the whole exploration of being heard and literally hearing and expressing your authentic voice. And that not being necessarily the persona or the personality voice, but something way deeper. And again, I really resonate with that because it's been such a privilege also for myself, not with a camera, but more with listening ears that are really just inviting others to hear themselves, a bit as much as see themselves.
I love that aspect too. So we really share that in common, interviewing people and finding out about whatever, especially people who have gone through these extraordinary experiences that are often labeled as psychosis or pathologized. I found that those places they go many times are very spiritual in their nature. And that's been fascinating. So in a way, doing these interviews that I have around Crazy Wise, the film that I did, was just another opening into my own exploration of my spirituality.
Beautiful, beautiful. Do say a lot more about that because this is just such crucial territory, really. As you know so well, you know, so many thousands of people that have been stigmatized for having these so-called psychotic experiences, when in fact the experiences themselves are very often derived from a very profound, imaginal and soul-filled, spirited world. And sometimes we're talking a really serious awakening and transparency of seeing. So it would be lovely. Do share, if you would, more about that crossover, your experience of this crossover.
So I spent almost, now it's going on 30 years, going into indigenous and tribal cultures. And then coming back to my own culture here in the United States. I live in Seattle. And just that going back and forth and seeing that contrast. And one of the things that really stuck out to me was how, relatively speaking, we're disconnected from each other, from the natural world, and from ourselves in a way that many of the people I was visiting in these cultures weren't. They have to depend on each other to survive in a very personal way. Mm-hmm. We do in a more or less impersonal way because we have institutions that help us with that. Mm-hmm. We have daycare centers for our kids. We have old age home centers for those of us getting older. Mm-hmm. We have Social Security. We have grocery stores. We have all these institutions that are mediated by our currency, our money. But in these more traditional cultures, the only thing they have is their relationship with each other. And they've got to maintain those relationships. Mm-hmm. And being human beings, we all run into conflicts. And we solve our conflicts, if they get out of hand, typically with third parties, lawyers.
Right.
And they can't do that. They don't have that luxury. They have to work it out. So it makes for a very connected community. Mm. And I really saw that in the community I grew up in when I was a kid in Utah, in that farming community, how everybody, we helped each other build our barns and haul our hay and do all those things. We did them communally. Mm. So that's one thing I noticed. But the other thing I noticed that really got me into doing the film Crazy Wise was the fact that their allowance for the human experience was much wider than ours when it came to consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of things like hearing voices or having visions, that was completely normal to them. That was, in fact, anybody that could do it was kind of looked up to. And it was surprising to me to see that their healers, the people we call shaman, their visionaries and healers, were often identified by having what we might call a psychotic break from reality. And that was fascinating to me. So I started meeting the healers by chance. I started with the Oracle of Tibet when I was doing work with the Tibetan people. Some people call him the Dalai Lama's Oracle. I got to watch him go into trance and got to interview him later. And he described, you know, hearing voices as a kid and having personality changes. And the other monks in his monastery recognized he had a potential to become what they call a Khutan, is a person who can, in our way of speaking, channel spirit entities and bring in a visionary sense to the community. The fact that, you know, he was identified that way, and then I started meeting other healers in Africa, and they had a similar story of being identified by having these extraordinary experiences. Then from that point on, I started asking, who are your healers? When I was doing a human rights story, and who are your visionaries here in the community? And I started interviewing them. And it was an aside to the work I was doing. It was just a curiosity.
Right. But,
it became later this film Crazy Wise, because I met a young man when I was doing a short film on meditation here in Seattle who had a psychotic break and who was immediately medicated and told he had a broken brain, essentially a chemical imbalance of his brain, that these drugs would restore that balance.
Right.
And I started investigating that as I started following him. And it became this film that took 6 years to do. The arc of his life took 6 years for me to document. But I learned so much about the crisis that our mental health care system is in right now. I didn't realize depression, suicide rates are all exponentially going up. And that story, the chemical imbalance story of mental illness, is really a myth.
Right.
It's never been proven that these experiences are caused by a chemical imbalance. Mm-hmm. We know we can give somebody a pill that will help raise the serotonin level in their brain and they'll feel better. Mm-hmm. But we've never proven that somebody that goes into these states has a low serotonin level or a high dopamine level that would cause these states.
Right.
That was just a theory that proved to be false.
Right. And just a response to the issue that's just dealing with the symptom that they're seeing just on the surface rather than the much deeper picture of this, of the wisdom of the individual.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
The wisdom of the individual is what also I've learned during the film and since the film came out, because so many people are contacting us and said, you know, I've had one of these experiences, and thank you so much for making this film, because I thought there was something wonderful about it, but I was afraid to tell anybody for fear they would call me crazy. But in the early stages of these experiences, I've come to believe that they're very spiritual in nature. And when I use the word spiritual, I always have to define it because it means so many different things to different people. But to me, it means something, a process that connects you to the whole, that connects you to each other, to the natural world, to the universe, that makes you feel like you're more a part of it than separate from it, viewing it. And so that experience of dropping ego boundaries or ego boundaries softening or dissolving happens in the early stages of many of these episodes we call psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
And that can, in itself, can lead, if the person successfully navigates it without becoming frightened. And typically where the fear comes in is they try to explain it to somebody else and there's no language for it.
Right.
The sense of egolessness, or where you've become a part of everything. when they try to explain that, if it's a young person explaining it to their parents, the parents get frightened.
Mm-hmm.
If they're explaining it to their spouse or lover, their partner gets frightened.
Mm-hmm.
Their best friends can get frightened because it's like an instant personality change.
Mm-hmm.
But it can lead to a lot more empathy and compassion coming out of the individual just because they realize they aren't separate from the other.
Yeah, and they absolutely have a quality of being and a perceptual field. It's as if they're opening to a perceptual field that is really denied so many people. If you look at our education system, which is all kind of left brain driven, you know, and based on the only reality is form and matter, right, and the mechanical nature of life, you know, obviously to actually dissolve that whole approach is inevitably going to be terrifying for people. I'm aware in my work with the voice that many people, when it actually gets down to it with why are people so terrified of actually sounding their voice? In other words, not singing a pretty song, but actually singing from the soul. It's because it's so foreign to so many of us to do that. And also that there's then that kind of terror of, if I go out, like that description of, oh my goodness, I might go out, I might soar away too far and not be able to get back.
Yeah, that is a
whatever
that
getting
is
back.
A real concern because yeah. Many people do that and end up hospitalized,
right,
or heavily medicated if mm-hmm. they've gone too far mm-hmm. beyond their comfort zone of mm-hmm. what they know and what they feel comfortable opening mm-hmm. up to.
With these people that you are meeting that have this capacity to really go out, you know, as Rumi says, beyond ideas of right and wrongdoing, you know, into that field of awareness where there is this sense of oneness, what is it that distinguishes when it's become so boundaryless that there isn't that capacity to be rooted in presence? In other words, I suppose it's the observational witnessing consciousness. Is it because that disappears as well? And that in order to really be able to navigate the oneness that you speak of, there has to be that skillfulness around being able to witness the journey? And if that witnessing component isn't there, is that what can make the difference between the challenge with navigating oneness? Because I mean, it is a vast... it's a vast thing, isn't it? You know, when we experience that, I was experiencing that. I was with the non-dual teacher, Harilal Punjaji, who came to be known as Papaji. And I was with him for 6 days in 1990. And nothing but the experience of being in the presence of this very elevated presence, someone whose very presence offers a transmission that literally disappears your mind. It disappears the ordinary mind. Wow. And then his main instruction is, well, now the egoic mind, not that he would describe it like this, he would just say, all you have to do is keep silent. Just watch. Well, just the capacity of watching the universality of being is, is quite quite a skill in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's it. It would have to be a skill that you've learned, I guess. Mm. You know, I have not gone into these extraordinary states. Mm. I try to, I meditate and I try to get there. But, you know, I always wondered what, you know, the skill of the shaman is to be able to go into those states and then come back and ground themselves.
Right.
And you have to have that ability. And I would imagine that their initiation is one of going into those states and not going too far, but then being able to ground and then going in again and maybe going in a little deeper and then coming back and learning. So I would think it would be a gradual, like any learning process, of taking a little bit at a time and getting comfortable with it, because the thing that can make the whole thing go haywire is fear.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's coming from the people around you that you're trying to explain it to, your best friends, your social network, and they're telling you it sounds like you're crazy. Of course, if you go to the doctors nowadays, they'll tell you, yeah, you've got a problem. And that in itself can cause a lot of distress. So just the framing of it that goes on in our culture. But yeah, I would imagine that, you know, like Adam, the main person in our film, the very first interview we did with him when I was just talking about meditation that he was using.
Yes.
He said when he was talking about his break that had happened 4 years before, his psychotic break. And he said, when it first happened, it was very fun and exciting. It was the first time I really felt at one with the universe, where I was it was me. And then I kept going, and then I went way too far, and then it got scary. I didn't even think of it at the time when he was saying that, but I've heard that over and over again as I've talked to, you know, well over 100 people, you know, so many people contact us, and I end up talking to them like I'm talking to you right now, asking about their experience.
I think this is where your work is just so brilliant, though, because it's a kind of compassionate bridge. As you were saying earlier, you realized in your early days that the camera itself becomes the observing presence, becomes the witnessing presence that is watching very benevolently, watching and being present to these extraordinary beings. And of course, your film, Crazy Wise, really demonstrates how Westerners themselves, with none of that shamanic lineage or background, have found ways to bridge these worlds.
I think it's a natural human tendency, really. Yeah, and the camera, as you said, and instead of the word benevolent, I would say non-judgmental.
The camera
is just, you know, what Adam told us, you know, I would get together with him every 2 weeks and 2 to 3 weeks and interview him. And what he said later about that experience was, it was so good to have somebody just to talk to, that where there was no judgment, there was no wanting to make me better, there was no expectations. I could just talk about my experience. And the camera was just this presence and me behind it. Asking questions, and that was the deep listening that is so healing to people that go into these states.
Lovely, lovely. Yeah. It sounds so simple, but it is just so profound and so essential, isn't it? That this deep non-judgmental listening, which is absolutely central to compassionate communication and compassionate life, really needs to be, and is, sounds like from what you've been saying, there's a chance that this is starting to come into the mental health system.
Yeah, there's a process called open dialogue that's starting to spread around the world. It started in Northern Finland about 30 years ago, where the psychiatric department said, we've got to do something. They had the highest per capita rate of schizophrenia, quote unquote, in Western Europe.
Wow.
And they're way up near the Arctic Circle, this little town of Torino, 70,000 people in Finland. And what they did is they started doing stuff like that. When somebody went into one of these states, first of all, they emphasized early intervention, get to them early. They went to where the person was. They didn't put the person in a ambulance or a police car and take them to an emergency room. They went to their place. They gathered their social network, whoever was appropriate, be it their parents or their partners or employers or lovers or whoever.
Yeah.
And they did this deep listening process that they called open dialogue.
Beautiful.
Where they just sat and didn't look at the person that was in that state as the problem. This was a problem of relationships, and they came at it from that point of view. And they have drastically dropped that per capita rate of schizophrenia down to the lowest in Western Europe. I mean, they've gotten amazing results. And that's it. It's simple. In a way, it's, as you say, it's not rocket science. It's very simple. It's deep listening, not being frightened. You know, when somebody, especially somebody you know, goes into one of these states, they're leaving, in a way, it sounds like they're leaving your reality. And and if you love that person, if you're a parent, you don't want them to leave your reality. You want it, you know your reality. You want, you're more comfortable in that. And if they're leaving it and talking about this other experience that is so different from theirs, it becomes frightening. And that's what we have to learn as culture, I believe, that there are other universes, other realities, and we can learn from those other spaces. That's what traditional people learn, that they could actually learn from those, whether they use that learning for healing or for predicting what they need to do with the crops or whatever to ensure their survival. They honored that.
Yes. Oh my God, there's just so much more, so many more questions I want to ask you about that. But did you want to just mention a little bit about your more recent work with scientists in Imperial College in London?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So what are these states
that
people go into? It turns out there's some common denominators that I've heard over and over again. I had this sense of unity, this sense of oneness. Sometimes they can't explain it like that. They'll say, I felt I was everything and yet nothing, or it was like I was a coat of paint over everything. I became invisible. But anyway, it was that sense of being connected. The other thing is creativity goes up. Inhibitions typically go down. Time either almost disappears or distorts very radically. You can have what psychologists called synchronicities, where you have a thought and then something happens that relates to that thought out of the blue. Very strong coincidences. So I've heard those over and over again. And it turns out that there's other ways that are being studied by scientists now with the new fMRI imaging that measures blood flow in the brain. So you can start mapping out networks in the brain, parts of the brain that work together that do very abstract things, like give us our sense of self as separate from the rest and give us our sense of time, both of which scientists and indigenous people have told us are both illusions. The Buddhists say our sense of self is an illusion. Scientists, since the quantum theories have come about, are seeing how time is very relative and can be called an illusion. So I see this blending going on right now between the scientific community and the spiritual community, so to speak. As you say, we've been dealing with matter mostly with our science, but now we're starting to see things as just energy, our spirit. And so the studies that fascinate me at Imperial College, it turns out that psychedelics like LSD and magic mushroom psilocybin are being used to see what network of the brain they affect. And it turns out they affect a network that's called the default mode network that's also affected by monks who have meditated for hundreds of thousands of years. Hundreds of thousands of hours. But the monks have been doing this for many years. But in terms of many, many hours of meditation, there's been work at MIT done by a scientist by the name of Judson Brewer, who's shown that that same network is involved in shutting down in a long-term meditator under the influence of psychedelics. That network shuts down. And the symptoms of of that shutting down are similar to what I've heard from people with lived experience, people that have gone through an extraordinary state spontaneously mm-hmm. without doing years of meditation or mm-hmm. taking a psychedelic. So in fact, psychedelics used to be called psychomimetics, mimicking a psychosis when LSD was first discovered. That's the name they put on it because those symptoms are so similar, that sense of oneness, that your creativity, or you see connections that you've never noticed before.
Yes.
All that happens, and it's very similar to what a person in early stage psychosis feels. Right. And the other thing, you mentioned Ram Dass, who was at Harvard with Timothy Leary in the early 60s.
Yeah.
He went off to India and gave up on the psychedelics and took a more meditative Eastern spiritual path.
Mm-hmm.
But he gave LSD to one of his teachers.
Neem Karoli Baba?
Yeah. And nothing happened. I mean, he was already in that state. So it's interesting that the work that's happening at Imperial College in London, the scientist there is Robin Carhart-Harris that I spoke with on this. And this work is becoming known in the mainstream. It was on our 60-minute program here in the U.S. I don't know if you get 60 minutes.
I'm not sure.
In the UK, but it's a very popular program here. It's mainstream.
Yeah.
And they were talking about this work going on at Imperial College and how we're looking at these extraordinary states through the eyes of psychedelic research, meditation, and starting to link it with the early stages of what we call psychosis. There's very common denominators there.
I would love to just do another whole conversation with you on the use of sound and music as well, and what part that can play and how that works on the brain and opens up the brain, and also can be used as a kind of skillful response to psychotic experiences that otherwise might be too mind-blowing to manage, you know, and how, for example, obviously things like the use of sacred chanting, mantra, and so on are all terrific modes of practice, as with our monks who would have been chanting, and that would be an integral part of their spiritual life.
That's
like another whole area. And then also how sound can be used to accompany the non-judging mm-hmm. mind, to listen, to be present to. So for example, one of the things I'm starting to explore, and I'd love to talk about this with you at greater length, is how when a person tells me they feel depressed, for example, and I say to them, what does that sound like? Once you've gone through the, oh, I'm not a musician, I don't have a voice, all of those kind of mm-hmm. attempts at sabotaging the experience, and you say, okay, well, here we are. And then the person will just start to sound what depression sounds like. They start moving into different modes, different musical intervals, that once you start locating those intervals and how they relate energetically in the body. So for example, if you think of your body from the root to the crown as a musical octave, and then you might be singing like a minor third. That's very often where the depressed mind will go, into the minor third and the minor sixth and the minor seventh. Those will all show up because that produces a lamenting melody that accompanies the experience of depression, which once you really keep listening to it and daring yourself to listen to what the sound of depression is, you start hearing yourself. And then if you have that non-judging observing mind present as well, you have the intuitive mind that is expressing the sound, and then you have the observing mind that is watching what is being expressed in quite a kind of, it's like slowing down the whole process, if you like. It's like going into slow motion with a mood that otherwise just left to its own devices without any witnessing mind, just gets out of control because it doesn't have any kind of supportive context to listen to itself. And that's presumably what makes it scary.
So you kind of run away from it and it isn't allowed to be expressed, and that's what causes the problem.
Right. And if
how interesting.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I'd love to, I'd love us to, if we may, just to have another dialogue in the near future where we can pursue this conversation.
As I say, 30 minutes goes pretty fast. But when I was in London last, about a year and a half ago, showing the film in different parts of the country.
Yes.
In the UK.
Crazy Wise,
yeah. The person I was with wanted to take me to a sound healing center.
Oh,
was
great.
Very well known. And I forget where it was, but we were in Bath at the time, headed for, where were we going? Newcastle, I think.
Okay.
But anyway, it was somewhere in between. And yes. We ran out of time and I didn't get to do it. So I would love to explore it. I'll probably be there this winter in February.
Excellent. Oh, well, let's meet and I'll do a bit of research and track down that place. There's a lot of research going on with the sound now. And I think that's probably where our respective worlds will meet again. I'm so grateful to you, Phil, for giving your time to exploring this absolutely essential area of understanding, the nature of compassion and what part it plays, through the bridging of your documentary work into these remarkable people's lives and just really opening the door on the wisdom of the individual once again. Thank you so much. And we will make sure that everybody knows how to get to see Crazy Wise, which is obviously essential viewing. And thank you so much.
Well, thank you. My gratitude to you for having me on the program.
God bless. Thanks to you.
Yeah. God bless.
Bye.
That sound inside.